Good NFL playoff games have finally arrived. Divisional playoff Sunday was spectacular with Aaron Rodgers outdueling Dak Prescott in Dallas, and Le'Veon Bell just keeps steamrolling defenses, this time in KC. Plus, how the Falcons did whatever they did against Seattle, and how the Texans held New England in check before falling. Plus, some thoughts on Tony Romo's next stop. All that and much more in the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I'm here with Andy Benoit. We are through divisional playoff weekend down to the final four. Andy, we had some really good games on Sunday, finally. And I think we both agree that what we'll remember most, it's the kicks.
It's the special teams plays. These were excellent games. And the nice thing was the points and these field goals, they kind of reflected the flow of the game. There were no, and sometimes it's fun to have these wild plays, but there were no ridiculous swing plays that skewed the score. These scores and these outcomes were very indicative of the way all eight teams played this
Absolutely.
Weekend.
Absolutely. We like that around here. We don't like crazy things happening.
Number one.
Let's jump right into it here, and we're going to start with topic number one, and that was certainly the game of the postseason so far, and it was billed as the game of the postseason so far, and it lived up to it. That was the Packers holding off the Cowboys in Dallas. Oh, there is so much from this game. My first instinct is to just put on the script that the two of us should yell simultaneously for like 10 minutes and then just move on, but I guess we'll zero in. I'll start with the play of Aaron Rodgers. They started really slow a week ago against the Giants. Took him a while to get going. That was not the case today. He lit it up. I mean, he had another huge day. They had a little lull sort of mid-game. He had a bad throw that resulted in an interception, which I think pretty much floored anyone watching that game. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what you do to stop this guy right now.
Yeah. Well, and that interception came on. It may have been the same play. It was certainly the same concept as the play he hit Adams on for the near touchdown late in the first half against the Giants
yep.
a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And why that's kind of noteworthy, this time he just missed the throw. It's the same concept, though. He saw them rotate the single high, and he knew he had one-on-one outside, and he let it loose. When he did that on that Adams play against the Giants last week, it was almost like a switch was flipped, and all of a sudden Aaron Rodgers rediscovered how to play on time and play on schedule and play within the context of the play designs. And that's what we saw continue into this game. And he's done it six quarters in a row now.
Yeah.
And coming in during this winning streak, the only games he'd actually done that and played on schedule in were the Philadelphia games, that Monday night one, and then the Minnesota game. I believe that was a Sunday game. Other than that, though, Rodgers had been an unrhythmic player like he's always been. He's a willy-nilly, different sandlot type of guy. But if he's playing on schedule like he has today against Dallas and he did in the second half against the Giants, he might be unbeatable. And the beauty of it, Gary, what makes him unbeatable is that by playing on schedule, you can always go back to sandlot mode when mm-hmm. you need to. And we saw that on the Jared Cook play on the 3rd and 20. Rodgers went right back into sandlot mode. It was appropriate. The situation demanded it.
Yep.
And he made an otherworldly play, but they were in position for that. The game was tied at that point because of the way he'd played leading up to that. He's a great quarterback when he's playing on schedule and on time. And if they do that in the championship, they're going to be hard to handle.
And you were right when you said on the Thursday show, just not a big impact going without Jordy Nelson in this one. Would have been nice to have him. Maybe you get another play or two out of this, but they had no problem moving the ball without Jordy.
Well, he's a puzzle piece for them, really. He's a great puzzle piece, but we've talked all season, Gary, injuries, the ones that really matter, not to denigrate anyone, the ones that really matter are if you have to change your style of play because that guy's out of the lineup. And within the context of Green Bay's offense and their approach, they don't really have to change who they are with Nelson out of the lineup. You could argue, in fact, that the most valuable guy in their passing game, other than Rodgers, of course, is Jared Cook, because when he's out of the lineup, they have had to change how they play. But he gives them such value as a weapon himself, but also the flexibility to move around and what he does for their formations. And I thought that was the biggest impact in the game today, again, was Jared Cook and all that he brings to the offense. They become such an expansive offense with him now in the lineup. They're 10-2 with him in there.
Yeah, flipping over to the other side real quick. Obviously, really good day for Dak Prescott. This stage was not too big for him. He went blow for blow with Aaron Rodgers here. I guess if I'm the Cowboys this morning, there are two things that are absolutely haunting me. They both came early in the game, and I'm curious if you would have any insight as to how this could possibly happen. There was we'll start with the Bryce Butler being in the huddle and then come back out. That's an unsportsmanlike illegal substitution, apparently. I knew it was illegal to do that. I didn't realize it was a 15-yard penalty to do that. So, is that on Butler? Is that on the staff? It seems like it would be something that would be on the staff.
No idea. That's a total communication issue, and we'll never know that unless someone in Dallas tells us, because we don't know how the communication broke down. Did Butler hear the wrong thing? Did someone accidentally call out the wrong package? Was it somebody else, and they were supposed to sub out, and Butler wrongly subbed out? We'll never know that answer.
Did you know that was a 15-yard penalty?
No, I figured it'd be five, but I understand the logic. 5 yards is if there are too many men in the huddle, but to sub a guy in and then out, it's 15. And the reason it's unsportsmanlike is because the defense is watching the substitutions. And if they see 12 guys go in, they can say, hey, wait a minute, something's wrong, and they can trust that the flag will be thrown. But if they see one guy go in and then come off where it's not really 12 guys, hey, what was that? Now you're messing with their ability to put the right personnel package on the field. So I understand it, and it's 15 yards because they want to truly discourage it and not even let teams mess around with the blurry line, because it's a real advantage. The defense, everything. Defense is watch your huddles. That's how they know who to put in the field, and then they look at that, and then they call their plays. They call their plays after they see your personnel.
Yep.
What was the other thing from this one? You said there were two.
Yeah, well, I was going to say they got caught in a substitution against Aaron Rodgers, which I don't know. I don't understand why teams still do that. I don't understand how that still happens.
The one that sticks with me is, and I was watching it, and I figured I must not understand the rules, but I've since read articles afterwards that I did understand the rules. When you call a fair catch and the half expires, or the first half or second half, you call fair catch and there's no time left on the clock, you are entitled to a free kick. And what a free kick is, it's a field goal attempt with no defensive rush. So it's basically you play 11-on-1 or you play 1-on-1. It's the kicker, the holder, I guess, 2-on-1, the kicker and the holder against the return guy. And if you kick it through the uprights, it's 3 points. And if you miss, then there can be a kick return on it. But the point is, Dallas had a free kick, and I don't think they realized that, because they didn't ask for it. They didn't get it. I don't know if the refs failed to offer it to them. But Dallas should have had a 73-yard field goal attempt, which sounds crazy, but it's a lot more makeable when you realize there's no pass rush, so it's like a kickoff. And they didn't do it. They flat out didn't do it. And this wound up 3 points kind of wound up being important in this game.
But I thought you would have backed off that because of the fact that you can return that. That's what I was thinking. I thought they wouldn't even consider it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, why not put out your kick coverage unit then and then do the free kick? Why wouldn't you do that? You're really I would have done it. I've only seen it done. I've watched 240 NFL games a year for 5 years in a row now, and I've only seen it done once in my lifetime. And on that play, the kicker tripped and barely hit the ball.
Yes.
So I don't even know if I've ever seen one. It's a Titans game.
Do you remember who it was?
Do you? You must remember. I want to say it was a Titans game. Was it a Cardinals game?
Sure. Sorry, say it again.
It was either a Titans or a Cardinals game, I want to say.
I believe it was Neil Rackers of the Cardinals.
That's okay. Yep. I remember because Wisenhunt was the coach, and he called for the free kick.
It was the biggest bummer in NFL history, because I remember I was at a party and the game was on in the background. And everyone was like, oh, they're doing the free kick thing. They're doing the free kick thing. And we all lined up to watch it. And he like, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I did.
He chunked it. He caught the turf first. And then, well, yeah.
And they didn't lose this game in Dallas because of the free kick. I mean, we know there are no butterfly effects, but they left an opportunity of 3 points on the board. So just putting that out there.
But also, the other thing, even if you're not going to take the return in consideration, it's unlikely you're going to make a 73-yard field goal.
Well, not if you're kicking off. No, I mean, if you're kicking off, you'd be kicking. It's the same as kicking off from... what, the 35-yard line?
They were at the 38. They would have had it at the 38. So
that's we see them. Well, that's the same as a kickoff. How many times have you seen kickoffs go through the uprights? That
but
happens.
You can't put it on a tee, can you?
I don't know that. And that's why we need to have more free kicks.
I think you just got to hold it. We got to get Chase anyway, on the podcast to tell us.
Yeah, he does a good job. He does a good job.
But yeah. Look, the kicks at the end, Dan Bailey and Mason Crosby were fantastic. Dan Bailey was kind of boring. He just sort of kicked his right through the uprights, whereas Mason Crosby kind of teased us all. Did a little. It was a kick Charlie Huff would have been proud of, knuckling those things through, just kind of messing with people's emotions.
You know, one other thing that stood out from this game, Gary, and I know we'll go on to talk about Dallas. Green Bay, we thought they would play five defensive backs all game long. Remember we talked on Thursday how Dom Capers, they run a different type of defense. They don't match up to personnel. They'll keep their defensive backs in, even if you're in run-heavy formations. And we saw the Cowboys go to 21 personnel, two backs, one tight end, and use a fullback as a lead blocker. We saw them at times go to six offensive linemen. And I believe Green Bay, through all of that, certainly the two backs and then two tight end sets, they stayed at nickel and often kept two safeties back deep, as they've done all season. And they didn't take away the Cowboys' run game, but they survived it well enough to win this game, obviously. And that's got to be pretty disappointing for the Cowboys.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, they lost points with that penalty, with that 15-yard penalty. I think that was the one that, when they look back, that's going to keep them up at night. Because everything else, I mean, they really... Yeah, Aaron Rodgers did the Aaron Rodgers thing, but they sort of played this game on their terms for the most part.
Yeah, they did. I mean, they had to come back from 18 down, but they were able to do that, and to their credit, they still maintained their run-pass balance. But it's tempting to run. If the other team's going to keep defensive backs in and give you a light six-man box, then running plays, even when you're down 18, those make sense. Both teams, bottom line, both teams played their style of football, and Green Bay won today.
Yeah. Now, this is a real good one. We will obviously have the deep dive on the NFC title game, Packers and Falcons. That is coming up on the Thursday show.
Number two.
But as for now, let's move on to topic two, and that is going to be a little look ahead to the Cowboys and what they are looking at in this offseason. They have Dak Prescott as their quarterback now. Personally, I would have put in Tony Romo for that single play where Dak threw the interception and then took him back out. That would have been my strategy there. But Dak's the guy. This team, you know, they need a pass rush. It's the same thing they needed last year, but you can't have everything. But I would think that would be their number one priority.
Yeah, I think you take the best. You could maybe say best defensive player available, but you certainly want to put some weight on the pass rushers and put those guys higher on your board. Probably best pass rusher available. And offense, they don't need to touch that this offseason.
Yeah.
They're going to get... keep in mind, they're getting Lyle Collins back, too, at left guard, and he's as talented as most of those other starters.
Yep.
So it's a great offense. I would take best defensive guy available. It's not a hard offseason approach. This one's pretty cut and dried.
Yeah, and Tony Romo figures to be moving on. Denver would seem to be the early favorite if there were actual betting odds. But
means, Garrett, that they could be in play for a major free agent signing then. Because if Romo's not on the roster, that's going to impact their salary cap, certainly.
Yeah.
So just something to keep in mind. You don't always have to go through the draft. I mean, this team is built already. And if they can find a Julius Peppers or their version of DeMarcus Ware, like what Denver's done and what Green Bay's done, that wouldn't be the worst thing.
I'll just say one thing about Romo, as long as we're speculating for a second. A lot of Texans fans looking for Tony Romo right now. I don't think Jerry Jones is going to send him to Houston. I think Jerry Jones is going to send him to the AFC and somewhere far away, but I think he doesn't want him in the state of Houston, making the Texans a Super Bowl contender there. So just my guess. I think the Texans would have to sort of overwhelm them with an offer to actually get Romo in their building.
Number three.
But plenty of that in the offseason. Right now, let's go on to topic three, and that is the Sunday nighter, the accidental Sunday nighter with the weather delay. And this ended up being a very good one as well. Chris Boswell all over this one. Record 6 field goals, keying the Steelers' victory over the Chiefs. Andy, this was one. We talked about Andy Reid and his record coming off of bye weeks. It was, I believe, 19-2 coming into this one. Could be maybe one off on that, so he's 19-3 now. You know, Chiefs came out, sort of those scripted plays that that Andy Reid has early in the game. They got the touchdown drive to start it, and then they really didn't do much of anything offensively for the rest of this one.
A lot of teams started hot this week. Dallas scored on their opening drive, if I recall. Green Bay, certainly. Seattle looked unbeatable.
Seahawks
we'll get
did.
To them. Yep. Kansas City got their touchdown. And New England came out bonkers and then kind of quieted off. But Kansas City, they're a manufactured offense, and they did the stuff they always do, misdirection, different formations. They make you defend multiple angles on the same play. What they've done so well lately that they didn't do in this game, it was for a variety of reasons. There were opportunities there. They weren't always attacked, and they weren't always converted when they were attacked, but they didn't get any of those deep shot plays, any of the designer deep shots. They didn't get them, and that was really, I thought, the difference in the game.
Yeah, Alex Smith left a couple of those on the field. NBC kept on showing that one in the first half where Tyreek Hill was just running with no one within 20 yards of him down the middle of the field.
A word of caution on that kind of thing. This is why, and I know people probably don't like you when I say this, but that's why you need the film, because it's one thing to show a guy streaking off, but if the coverage dictates that your reads go to one side of the field, then sometimes that's going to happen. A guy, you don't know they're going to bust a coverage on the spot you're not looking. And a quarterback can't see everything at once. So we need to Chiefs fans, I would just tap the brakes. You're probably wanting to criticize Smith, and maybe it's fair, but we need to wait and get the full bird's eye view on that one. My sense was there were a few plays in question like that, and I'm really eager to see what went on right there.
That's the most passionate defense you have ever offered of Alex Smith.
Well, I mean, you can't say a guy left throws in the field. We don't know that yet. Smith has done that before, but he has not done that a whole lot this season. He's been much better in that regard.
Right.
And again, a guy, no one's arguing that Hill was wide open. Of course he was wide open, but that doesn't mean he was part of the progression. That doesn't mean that Smith was supposed to see him based on how the play's drawn up. You can't ever call a play under the assumption that someone's going to blow a coverage. The backside, especially. So let's just wait and see. Tune in on the Thursday show. We'll check back in on that one.
All right.
Somebody send a mailbag question so we remember to do it, because otherwise we're not going to.
Steelers offensively all about Le'Veon Bell in this one, as they have been for the last month and a half, 2 months at this point. Ends up 30 carries, 170 yards. Ben, he was all right. He missed a couple throws in this one. The one interception was deflected, not really something he could do anything about. But no one's figuring out Le'Veon Bell. I mean, everyone's expecting him. No one's stopping him.
Well, he's a great running back playing behind a very good offensive line. So even if you do figure him out, that might not matter. We say it every week, and we're going to say it again, because there's the more America sees Bell, the more we hear about this talk of a revolution. Are people going to change the way running backs run the ball back in high school? Will they coach it differently? The way Le'Veon Bell, he's able to do that because when he decides to go, he can go so quickly and smoothly. So it doesn't matter if LeGarrette Blount were out there running, or just any, you know, or Kenneth Dixon, just pick a running back, even a good quick one like Baltimore's Kenneth Dixon. If those guys ever came to a complete stop in the middle of the play, they're not going to go gain 6 yards on their next step the way Le'Veon Bell does. He's a unique talent with unbelievable stop-start ability and agility, and there's a smoothness to him. So there might be a revolution. People might try to run like that. No one else is going to run like Le'Veon Bell. Very few guys will do it.
You know what? And sorry to back up, and this is a complete non sequitur, but you know what I liked most about the Packers-Cowboys games? The Aaron Rodgers touchdown to Jared Cook down at like the 5-yard line, and then the Dak touchdown to Jason Witten. They both had such weird ball fakes on that. And they were completely nonsensical. They weren't even like motions that you would normally do when you're faking a handoff to someone. But they were so weird and their movements were so weird. I feel like it froze defenders because you were just kind of like, what is happening? That kind of faked a handoff and then like very dramatically almost like sort of patted Ezekiel Elliott on the back and like pushed him forward like, there you go, buddy.
Well, and they did that on the Dez Bryant touchdown, too. The Witten and Bryant touchdowns were the same kind of concepts. I'm going to try to connect these dots for you because you're right. This was a bit of a non-sag.
Yes.
We're way back. I'm trying to figure out what street we're on now.
But my guess is you're talking about patience. Le'Veon Bell.
Right. You're talking about concepts that make defenders, especially middle of the field defenders who are used to playing fast, we're talking about forcing them to play slow, forcing them to play on your schedule. And that really ties back into Kansas City, too. And that's the nexus of their offense is they force you to try to get you playing fast as well because they do all the misdirection. But if you're coaching against it, if you're the Steelers, you're telling your guys you have to play slow against these teams. You have to see the field. That's kind of what football's become a little bit. It's manipulating second-level defenders with your tactics, whether it's play action or in Pittsburgh's case, these delay runs with Le'Veon Bell. Shotgun draws are another thing they've started to do with him a little bit. These are different types of players we're talking about. Le'Veon Bell's such a unique talent. He's like a Dak Prescott, Ezekiel Elliott. When you have unique talents, you can handle the ball differently. You can play with more patience.
I love the Steelers play calling on the last two plays in this one. I thought that the clock was not enough of a friend. I thought they needed a first down there, considering a field goal won it for KC.
It was gutsy. No question it was gutsy, especially when you had run the ball at will against them. You hadn't been running in obvious running situations necessarily, but Pittsburgh's been very good running out of heavy formations with extra tight ends. With Hubbard, there's six offensive linemen out there. So to call pass plays, that certainly took some courage, and it worked out well for him.
Yep. Yeah, kind of a bummer for the Chiefs, and I understand why he was out there, but boy, seeing they had to drop Justin Houston into coverage on that last play. I mean, 3rd and 3 is difficult enough against the Steelers, and sort of having your superstar edge rusher who just he just didn't have it this year. The injuries were too much to overcome, and to sort of have him out there in coverage on what was basically the play that ended your season had to sting a little bit.
Yeah, and when the other play that he was in coverage was the Antonio Brown 54-yard catch. And I know what fans at home are saying is, how can you do that? That was not bad coaching. That you dropped him into coverage because you're banking on the way you draw it up, that you're expecting the blitz to get home before the coverage can become a factor. The blitz did get home. Roethlisberger just made the blitzer missed, and that's not the first time that's happened to someone. And if you want to complain about it, you can say we shouldn't draw up blitzes under the assumption that they'll tackle Roethlisberger when they get to him. But in that case, then you're saying, well, we shouldn't blitz at all. I mean, you got to assume the blitzer will tackle the QB when he reaches him, even if it is Ben Roethlisberger. So, Chief fans, don't lose your minds over that. It wasn't Bob Sutton losing his mind. It just Roethlisberger made a great play.
Yeah. And look, this is going to be Roethlisberger Brady 2 in the postseason as far as that goes. Last time they met was when Roethlisberger was a rookie. That was the 15-1 Steelers team. And I remember vividly Romeo Crennel was the Patriots defensive coordinator in that game. He had consistently one or two players rushing Roethlisberger and dropped everyone else back into coverage and just said, not even going to blitz him, not even going to rush him, not even going to give the opportunity, because Roethlisberger was so good against the blitz as a rookie, and obviously he has always been good against the blitz. But
it's a different Roethlisberger this time. When you blitz a rookie, you're simplifying things for him because the coverage has become predictable because there aren't very many guys back in coverage, and you force him to get the ball out quickly, and Roethlisberger was horrible at that early in his career. It took him 8 or 9 years to get to become an on-schedule quarterback. Now he sees the field so well, and he's so much more mature. So I'm not saying you don't do it, but we'll see. It's a different Roethlisberger this time around. My guess is they'll do something like that, though. New England will probably do a lot of rushing 3 and dropping 8. And we'll talk more on Thursday about it, but if you're stopping the Steelers these days, you're starting with Le'Veon Bell. You're not starting with Roethlisberger anymore.
Yep.
Not this season. Not this year.
We will have the full deep dive on Thursday, Patriots-Steelers AFC title game. But right now, let's move on to topic number four.
Number four.
And that is a quick look ahead to the Chiefs offseason. AFC West, by the way, fails to win a postseason game, as good as that division was all season. Now, the Chiefs, you figure things will mostly stay the same. The two big free agents they have here, Eric Berry, who is on the franchise tag this year, and Dontari Poe is also a free agent. He is due a large raise. Would you even flirt with the idea of letting either of these guys walk, Andy?
They might have to flirt with the idea of letting Poe get away. I'd have to look closer to at their salary cap implications and how they're set up there. They don't have a super expensive quarterback or a super expensive running back, and that helps, but it's hard to afford everybody, and they've been very good bringing different defensive linemen along up front. And Dontari Poe, good as he is as an athlete, I think he's as good as anyone his size especially. He's part of the 26th rated run defense in the NFL, and he's part of a run defense that got its hats handed to him again tonight. So if they decide, hey, we're going to spend a bunch of money in a different position, it's something to consider. I don't think you let Barry get away under any circumstance, and I don't think they will. Poe might be worth considering, not because of him, but because of his price tag.
Mm. Well, they also, look, they'll have Alan Bailey and Jay Howard back next year. Those guys were, they would have come in handy in this one, but
they would have. And they also have, I think Raheem Nunez-Rochez has showed signs at times, and they have Chris Jones. And keep in mind, they used a second-round pick on Jones. I know he plays a different position than Poe, but sometimes teams tell you what their plans by who they draft, and they maybe would not have used such a high draft pick on a guy at a position that they were pretty well set at unless they thought that position group would be changing the next season, unless they thought they're not re-signing Poe in this case.
All right. All right, Andy. Before we hit topic five, just a real quick reminder. We will have the deep dive show, the look ahead show on Thursday, all about the AFC and NFC title games. Mailbag. Send your questions for the mailbag. We will answer as many as we possibly can. You can send them to Twitter, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI. You can send them to our respective Facebook pages. Always good because you can write as long as you want to write. Just search our names on Facebook. And, of course, you can send you talkback at themmqb.com. Just put podcast somewhere in there so that we see it. But send those questions. We'll also have a little bit of coach hiring talk on Thursday. I know we promised it in this show, but we're going to push it back to Thursday because too much stuff happened.
Number five.
Right now, let's go into topic five, and that was the Falcons cruising. Easy victory over the Seahawks. Kyle Shanahan just laying waste to any defense that gets in his way. Julio Jones only played 42 snaps in this game. Had a little aggravation of the toe injury. Obviously, it helped that Atlanta was protecting a lead for most of the second half, but I mean, look, this was, this was an offense that could not be stopped.
And as a compliment to Atlanta and that offense, and kind of to Jones in a way, to the kind of player and person he is, he's become a little bit more of a puzzle piece for them. When he's been out of the lineup, the offense has functioned just fine still. And when he re-entered the lineup, they did not change their approach fundamentally. I'm not saying Julio Jones is anything less than a top five receiver, which he absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And he's their most important offensive player other than Matt Ryan, maybe other than Alex Mack as well, up at center there. But it's a very well all-around functioning offense. They spread the ball around better than any team in the NFL. We saw that again against Seattle. And they went after Seattle. They did exactly what we thought, Gary. Both teams did. Seattle played more man coverage because they had to, because Atlanta went after their zone concepts with extraordinary success.
Man, I just got to say, there were a couple moments in this game where it was, just 10, 12, 15 yards, just chunks of passing yards, and then Shanahan would mix it in with a little outside zone run that would get 7 or 8 yards, and boy, I mean, he was just pressing all the right buttons in this one.
He understood how to go after those linebackers in their coverages, and that's mm-hmm. a good spot to do. It's over the middle of the field. It's easier to work route combinations there. they've done a great job. The other thing, Gary, you mentioned outside zone runs with Freeman and Coleman. Freeman and Coleman are the best 1-2 running back duo in the NFL, and it's not remotely close. Mm-hmm. Those are probably two of the NFL's 10 best running backs. They play different styles of football, so they complement each other well, but they have the same strengths. They can do the same outcomes, but they get to them differently. They're different styles of players that you can still do similar things with. And I think Coleman's a great one-cut runner, and Freeman's a creator on the outside, and both are dominant in the passing game.
So I would ask you this, and let's go to the parallel universe where Earl Thomas did not get hurt. Does this game play out any differently? Was it a matter of Atlanta exploiting what the Seahawks can't do without Earl Thomas, or was this one where Atlanta was just going to move the ball, they were going to get their points regardless?
It was both, because Steven Terrell has really struggled in the post-catch phase. Guys are catching passes between the numbers, and he's not making the play. Mm-hmm. And that's not a – keep in mind, Steven Terrell's a young backup. They didn't expect him to be in here. If you asked him at the front of the season, he's not expected to make these plays necessarily. You lose Earl Thomas, the league's best free safety. That's going to hurt your defense. So it's not a knock on Terrell. Having said that, if you are on the field, you have to make the free safety plays. You're responsible once you're out there, and he didn't get it done. So that Earl Thomas injury, that wound up being an enormous one for Seattle because it became more and more of an issue with each passing week.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll transition into topic six here and talk some Seahawks. Of course, if you are a Falcons fan, you'll have to listen to Thursday when we deep dive the rematch with the Packers at the Georgia Dome.
Number six.
But topic six here, this is going to be the Seahawks look ahead. Defensively, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily change anything. Obviously, you get Earl Thomas back, and they have locked up Michael Bennett, so you don't have to worry about that hanging over your head anymore. It seems like offensive line is still, I mean, we talked about a year ago, they were in dire need of help on the offensive line. It seems like they're okay inside. You got Britt at center, Glowinski, and you just spent a first rounder on a Fetty over at the right guard spot. But I mean, these tackles, I guess we'll start with George Fant specifically. Obviously a developmental guy. I mean, he was playing basketball last year, but boy, it seems like he's like 2 years away. I can't believe he was on the field.
And maybe it says more about Reese Odhiambo, their third rounder out of Boise State,
yeah.
Because he's the guy that you kind of would think would be in the competition when he was in there for Ifedi when Ifedi was hurt. Odhiambo played a lot in this game. He had some mistakes. He didn't play great. Now he's playing right guard. Maybe that's not his position. I don't know where he's been working all season long, but George Fant, an undrafted rookie, made the starting lineup, and their third-rounder, Odhiambo, did not. So there's two ways to look at that. I think there's one way to look at it at this point, because it's not fair to call either guy a bust after the rookie year, especially the one that's playing the position for the first time in his life and is really new to the sport. So those are developmental guys, which in that case, they've addressed a position already. These are the guys they have. I don't think they're going to go out and get – they might find a right tackle, someone that can replace Gary Gilliam on that spot. But they drafted Odhiambo. Clearly, they feel he's going to play for them someday. They wouldn't have used a third-round pick on him if they thought he was a backup. And George Fant, they have a season of tape to work with and see what they like, what they don't like, and they can work with him over the offseason. The problem is you don't have a lot of time with these guys in the offseason anymore. So I don't know how you develop George Fant. Hopefully, he gets set up with some kind of coach outside of Seattle, which the Seahawks can probably help arrange somehow. These are the guys, Gary. They've addressed a position already. It just takes a little bit of time for it to manifest into success.
Yeah, this was I don't know. I feel like the Seahawks get a little too cute with these developmental guys in the offensive line. And I think it's fine if you want to have one or maybe two of them, but it seems like they just sort of stack the roster with them. And then when it comes down to it, you got to play one of them, and he can't play. George Fant might be able to play in a couple of years, but he can't play right now.
The other position, because Deshaun Chedd tore his ACL in this game, and that was a real shame. So now you wonder what's his status for next season. They need an outside corner. He had become a very good one for them, and he's an exceptionally good tackler. He fits their scheme very well. Jeremy Lane's a nickel slot guy, and I think he's fine there. I think they have a decent one in that. But they might be in the market for another cornerback to play opposite Sherman now, too.
Bring back Brandon Browner again.
They did that. He did not make the team.
I know. We missed him this year, though. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Deshaun Shedd had a really nice year. He was one
and
of the,
he got better as the season went along too. He's a former safety that became a cornerback, which tells you one, he's a talented individual, but two, it's a little bit of a different scheme there in Seattle, and they don't need speed at the corner position, which means they're picking from a whole different group of corners than almost the rest of the NFL is. Look at NFL, they look for athletes at cornerback, and that's why so many of them go in the first round. If you don't need athletes, if you need strong guys, long, lanky guys, which is clearly how Seattle does it, then you're picking from a different pool of talent. That's why they find these guys late, because they're still getting the best of their styles. Their style is just not one that the rest of the league's looking for.
Yeah, that was a sad story out of this one, the Deshaun Shedd injury. But yeah, we'll see how that goes in the offseason. But for now, let's move on to topic number 7.
Number 7.
And that is the Saturday night game. Andy and I disagree over the quality of this game. This is the Patriots' win over the Texans. This is all I'm going to say, Andy. The Patriots offensively played a miserable game. The Texans did some very good things defensively. I will admit that. But for the Patriots, I guess I'm throwing a special teams in there when I say the Patriots turned it over 3 times. This was not a good game from the Patriots. And they turned it over 3 times, and they still won by 18 points. So I don't know how good the I think it was better than people expected. I think people were expecting this one to be 53-0, but yeah, I don't know. I had to live tweet this thing for the MMQB account and
that's why you didn't like it. That live tweeting thing sucks. And every day I thank myself for emailing our editor, Mark Moravik, at the front of the year and saying, you have to excuse me from this. I'll be horrible at it. Just don't make me do it. And I
was regretting
my
decision by, like, I don't know, with about 12 minutes to go. I really wanted out of there. But yeah. Andy, tell me why this game was good.
No, I don't think it was like a great game, but everybody went in totally dismissing this game, almost laughing at it, and it was not that kind of game. You can't tell me you weren't intrigued in that first half when the score was close and Houston really wasn't playing well, but somehow the score was still close and their defense was playing well. But Houston, they did exactly what they thought we would do, right, or what we thought they would do. Their offense couldn't move the ball, but it was a ball control approach. Their defense had to make a few plays, and they had to get a swing play here or there. They did that for half the game, and it made it a compelling game. Now, it turned out being 18 points, so everybody's going to say, oh, I told you so, this game's no good. They made New England play a complete game in this one. New England ultimately did, but they challenged the Patriots. This was a respectable professional contest.
Yeah. Well, look, again, Texans defense, yes, absolutely. This reminded me of, and I know, I think we talked about this, I think this is the Monday nighter that you missed, the Ravens-Patriots Monday nighter, where the Patriots were in total control, and then they had 2 fumbles on special teams deep in their own territory, and that sort of turned it around. And look, that's part of the game, but, you know, you were kind of sitting there at halftime when it was a 1-point game or whatever it was at halftime, it was a 4-point game, and it was just kind of like, you know, are the Patriots going to turn it over 2 more times in their own territory? Probably not. And even if they do, are the Texans going to convert twice in the red zone? Probably not. So that was my pessimism while watching this game.
Well, first of all, I did see the film on the Monday nighter, so I don't want people thinking I backed out of a Patriot-Raven game, because you don't do that with teams that might have met in the playoffs. The difference, though, in that one, the Ravens got easy points, and it swung the score, swung the game. This one, in New England, here, Deion Lewis offset it. He had the fumble and he had the touchdown. So it was a wash, and the score was still indicative of how the game went. I thought, and why would you say New England's offense, it didn't play like itself to a certain degree, but they made a number of big plays in third down and long, and that was the difference. And Tom Brady this season, did you know his passer rating in third down and long, like 6 yards plus, is well over 100, which is obscene. And even in third and 11 plus, he's been up in that area this year. Mm-hmm. This has become, I think, Gary, we need to kind of reevaluate the way we look at New England's offense. People like me are always talking about their quick strike game. How do you stop this quick strike game? They become much more vertical this season. They're not a vertical offense, but they're more of a balanced offense. North, south, east, and west. That's how they play now. They're not just east and west anymore. And in this game, they were great going north and south. They killed Houston on several critical downfield plays that were the difference.
I was going to say, I wanted to ask you very specifically about this game. Is there something about the Texans' defensive backs where teams know that they sort of, have trouble locating the ball when they're running downfield? I just say that because the big, sort of the big vertical plays the Patriots had in this game, they were high lofted, deep passes that were sort of, you know, one-on-one coverage downfield. And I didn't know if there was something where it showed up on film where the Texans guys just have trouble in those situations sort of basically locating the ball when they have to turn around.
I haven't seen that at all this season. I think what it was, it's the Brady factor. And the play to me that best illustrates it, it was the Edelman, I believe it was Edelman, got matched up deep. It was on a cover zero type of blitz. And the blitz came, and Brady realized, just based on the pre-snap alignment, he instantly realized that Edelman was going to be the guy that was matched against the safety. And someone had to match up against the safety. Houston was in a zone matchup concept, so it wasn't pure man-to-man. And Brady just located it. Brady located matchups downfield very well, and it's hard to know. I mean, you know, he wasn't pressured at times. So a lot of these big throws came late in the down. And when they come late in the down, then the quarterback's body language and positioning changes. We haven't had to see Houston's corners cover for 6 or 7 seconds very often this season. Mm-hmm. There were a few big plays in this game where they did, and Brady read them, and he punished them for it.
Yep. No, they were odd plays. They were unusual throws. I will say that.
They were. They did. Yeah, it did not look like a typical Patriots game. I agree with you on that. And it was the Hogan 45-yard play, by the way. That's the one I was looking through my notes trying to remember. Edelman had a 48-yarder on 3rd-and-9. That also was one where they rushed 3 and Brady directed traffic, and that's kind of what we're talking about. But the Hogan 45-yarder on 3rd-and-10 a little earlier, that's where it looked like cover zero blitz, and Brady knew exactly where the mismatch was. It was against Chris Moore, the safety. So if you're not going to get to Tom Brady, if you're going to give Tom Brady 6, 7, 8 seconds to throw, you're going to lose the game.
Yeah. Yeah. That Hogan 45-yarder was also, that was when things were starting to turn a little bit. Bill O'Brien had finally scored a touchdown on the Patriots, and it looked like the Texans might be in this one. And look, you're right. They stayed, the score stayed close. But just the way it stayed close, it did not seem like it was something that was possibly going to sustain itself for 60 minutes. That was my only point.
It didn't. Yeah, but, yeah. It didn't.
I thought, Romeo Crennel had a nice night, I thought. I thought the Texans did some really, really neat things on defense. But
number 8.
Let's move on to topic number 8, and that is the look ahead to the Texans offseason. Look, if J.J. Watt comes back, this is a pretty ridiculous defense. They were number 1 in total defense. We heard that plenty. I don't think anyone would consider them to be the best defense in football, despite that rating. But you put Watt in this lineup, and you got something pretty special.
I think if you add Watt, they're the best defense in football. Also, remember, they lost Kevin Johnson, who is their best cornerback. Mm-hmm. He's their most talented corner, and I think he's built for to have a heck of a career in the slot if they want to develop him that way. I think he's tailor-made. He's got excellent quick change of direction ability out of his back pedal. So if you add J.J. Watt plus a guy who could be a veritable number one corner to a team that, let's say, you have to find a way to re-sign AJ Bouye, because he had the kind of year where someone's going to pay him a lot of money, so he might not be easy to retain. And if you know you've got Johnson back, maybe you let Bouye get away. But the point is, this defense has a chance to add the league's most dominant, not a chance, they're going to add the league's most dominant defensive front player, plus an elite cornerbacking talent, and already they're a handful to deal with. It's a great defense. They're in a very good spot on that side of the ball. Too bad J.J. Watt or Clowney or Merciless, all these stars, too bad none of them can throw the ball.
I know. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, I don't see how they get rid of Brock Osweiler. It would if they release him, it's a $25 million cap hit. No one's gonna trade for him. I think they're just stuck with him for another year. I don't know. I know people have visions of Tony Romo. Like I said, I don't think Romo stays in state. I think you're Jerry Jones. You don't want him anywhere near your building or near your headlines in this case.
Well, but Jones, I mean, they're also in the AFC South. I mean, let's not get carried away with that completely. If I don't think they're going to go get Romo, because you can't afford Romo and Osweiler under the numbers that it would cost to have them.
The theory is you flip Osweiler and a pick for Romo.
And make Dallas have to carry Osweiler as the backup?
Yeah.
I think if you can do that, it's worth... It's interesting, because Houston's in a position right now that they have a Super Bowl defense without question.
Mm-hmm.
And the offense is not there. And so what is this team's window? Like, we just talked Seattle, and Pete Carroll said our window's at its widest open point right now, and he's right. That Seattle's not, we're not worried about Seattle getting their opportunities lost. They're going to be in the discussion for 4 or 5 more years. Houston's not really in that spot. They are on one side of the ball, but they're so pieced together on offense, and I guess we're talking about a team with its quarterback issues. Maybe that gets solved with the Romo. Maybe that does put you in Super Bowl contention right there.
It does, and I think that's exactly why Dallas doesn't send him there.
But why would Dallas care if Houston's in the Super Bowl? They're not going to obstruct Dallas's path to the Super Bowl, and because if Dallas gets a first-round pick out of it,
well, that's the thing. If you get blown away by the offer, then yeah, you might do it. But if you have similar offers from Denver, Houston, and whatever, one other team, whoever you want to throw in there in the mix, I just, to send him to Houston to keep him in state and basically make the Texans potentially the best team in football, I mean, come on, Tony Romo winning a Super Bowl with the Houston Texans, maybe meeting the Dallas Cowboys, I think that's a worst case scenario for the Cowboys.
But the Cowboys, no, the worst case is the Cowboys don't get to the playoffs or something. I mean, the Cowboys wouldn't look at it like, well, we don't want to send Houston to the Super Bowl. They're looking at it like, how can we send ourselves to the Super Bowl? And they're America's team. So they're not going to lose the state of Texas. Joe Cowboys fans not going to say, oh, those Texans look pretty good, maybe I'll just switch allegiance here. That's not going to happen. And for two, Dallas is such a large following, I would hope they're not worried about the marketing side of it, which is kind of what I'm guessing that you're talking. And, of course, we're talking in theory here.
It's on the marketing. It's the pride side of it.
Which is even stupider than the marketing side then. I would hope Jerry Jones has grown out of that.
But, my God, have you seen his building? No, he hasn't grown out of that.
But the building's a way to make money. He's not, I mean, I'm sure he's a prideful guy, but he's a smart business guy. Giving Houston something that's advantageous to Houston, but if it's advantageous to you, that's fine. Jerry Jones should not wish ill on the Texans because of his pride. That would be very foolish if he lets that impact the way he does his thing. And by the way, to our listeners, we're acting like this Romo thing's a done deal. This is total theoretical. We're BSing here. I mean, this is just theory talking. But
Andy, I'm not saying that they'd absolutely cross Houston off the list and say no way. I'm just saying the Texans have to pay a premium to get him.
Well, anybody would. He's a veteran quarterback.
But I'm saying
he's a star veteran
in comparison to what, say, the Denver Broncos would have to offer.
No, I don't think you. I don't think you charge. So you're saying you charge the Texans more than you would the Broncos. All right.
Yes.
So, all right. Here's where I'll agree with you, and I'm not going a penny further than this. If it's 100% apples to apples, Houston and Denver, nothing else is different, which is not going to be the case because that's impossible to get a deal that way. But if it is, then fine. I would go to Denver instead of Houston because of the pride of Texas and all that stuff that really doesn't do anybody any good.
There you go.
But if it's If it's so much as one penny different and it favors Houston, then I'm giving them to Houston.
All right. I disagree, Andy. But I also kind of agree with the last thing you said. We're in more agreement as we wrap this one up. Well, there's our imaginary talking points for the Tony Romo trade to Houston that's surely coming up. I don't think so. I don't think they keep him in the NFC, and I don't think they keep him in Texas. That's just me. We'll see what happens.
Number nine.
But let's go on to topic nine. This used to be the lightningest round. Andy killed it. Andy killed the lightning round. We'll bring it back next season, I guess. But this is just like a regular topic now, and it's not going to have to do with the games. We're going to talk a little bit of coaching. We will have deeper dives on the coaching guys on the Thursday show. But right now, we're just going to do one apiece. Andy, what was your, let's say, favorite or most surprising or most disappointing coaching hire of the past week?
I think disappointing is just that Kyle Shanahan hasn't gotten a job. And my guess is, and John Lynch kind of hinted at this in the broadcast Saturday, and a broadcaster on television where they're partners with the NFL, they usually don't say something like this unless they've heard something substantial behind the scene, but sounds like maybe Shanahan doesn't interview well yet. He comes across young or kind of cocky. He's the best coordinator in the NFL without, I mean, it's not even close this season. He has embarrassed some really good defensive coaches, embarrassed them, and nobody took him as their, it sounds like no one's taking him. I don't think San Francisco is going to hire him. It looks like Josh McDaniels, if he wants it, could take that job, and I would hope McDaniels would hold out and wait for a more stable job next year or the year after that. But I guess the Shanahan non-hire is kind of what stood out to me about these coaching decisions.
Yeah, they have to have an intervention if like NFL has to intervene on this and just assign him as someone's head coach. If, that's the way it's going to go. Could you imagine
or his dad can sit him down and say, "Son, come on, you know, scale it back a little bit. You're ready to go. Scale it back."
But could you imagine
if
the Falcons won the Super Bowl and they got to keep Kyle Shanahan as their offense coordinator? That'd be unfair. I was surprised Anthony Lynn. One, I was surprised he wasn't the pick in Buffalo, but I guess things are getting a little bit wacky there. It's Sean McDermott, whatever, he's fine. But I thought they'd keep him there. And then I was surprised that the Chargers turned around and hired a guy with, I don't know, Chargers are a mess. This whole move to L.A. is an embarrassment. And to bring in a not only a first-time guy, but a guy who is, you know, he was a position coach this time last year. He's a position coach on Labor Day this year. You know, Anthony Lynn's going to be a good head coach. This is a tough situation to bring him into, though.
Keep in mind, and I haven't seen a ton of moves in my life. I'm 30 years old, and these teams aren't relocating every year, of course. But it never ends nicely. The moves are never smooth. It always feels like a mess, and how can you do that to the city, and what a travesty. That blows over. That moves on, and it blows over, and then you have a football team, and now it's going to be in L.A., and they'll get their logo figured out, and they'll go on and play. So it's as messy as it can possibly be right now, but it's going to get a little bit less messy soon. Maybe not this year. This year might be rough. But at some point, this stuff will sort itself out. They're not going to be in total limbo there. Good for Anthony Lynn to get the job. I was a little surprised. I didn't know he was on the radar for San Diego/LA. And I was happy to see him get that opportunity. It must have been pretty disappointing for him when Buffalo went in a different direction. Yeah. Unless he knew he was high on the radar with the Chargers. As I understood it, he was flying to L.A. to interview with the Rams, it sounded like. And the Rams decided, we got to get McVay wrapped up now. That's our guy. We want to jump at him. And they did. So Lynn, I guess, just took the next appointment in L.A. And it happened to be the new team there, the other new team there.
You got to tell us all about McVay and golf on Thursday. If you listen to nothing else this week, listen to Andy talk about Sean McVay and Jared Goff on the Thursday show. That would be really good. Those are two guys you know very well.
Yeah, that is. It's kind of a nice duo. I spent a lot of time with McVay, and then Goff I spent some time with, and I got along well with both of them, which isn't anything relevant at all to what kind of coaches they are or what I think of them, except that you get more information that way. You get a better feel for guys, and I'm very eager to see how the duo plays out like that.
Yeah. I'm terrified about Jared Goff and what happened to him this year and sort of what he devolved into as the year went on. So I would like to hear some positive things about that duo, and the fact that McVay would be willing to take that job, I think is
all right.
I think it bodes well.
One quick one so we don't leave it on like a horrifying note like that. You said terrified. He did get better at climbing the pocket this season and keeping his eyes downfield, which for a guy that got hit a lot, that's a very encouraging sign. So I think that's where McVay starts. You work right there. They're going to need a better offensive line for him, though.
All right. I'm going to end it on a really positive note. You know what my favorite coaching hire of the week really was?
Yeah.
Bryce Paup, University of Minnesota defensive line coach. They poached him from Northern Iowa.
Is that where Bryce Paup is now? All right.
Yes.
Bryce Paup was the first. He was the first like player who I knew, like I knew who he was, whose cell phone number I got years ago.
Whoa.
And I never, but he never returned my call. I was early in college. I was absolutely nobody. He was Bryce Paup. He once had 18 sacks or whatever it was for the Bills. But I still got to put him in my phone, you know. And you put him in there all casually, like, oh, here's my friend Brian. Here's my friend Brian, too. And, oh, yeah, Bryce Paup's in there. It's nice and casual. That's what makes you feel great about yourself.
Did Bryce Paup. Bryce P or B Paup?
I had it Bryce, because I wanted anyone that came across it, I wanted to have the full name there, because I don't think he's known enough that you'd say B Paup and someone go, hey, is that Bryce Paup in your phone there? B Paup? That's got to be Bryce Paup. I don't think he's that kind of famous. So I had the full name in there with him. I'm sure I still have it. I never delete anybody of any notoriety, even though he's probably changed his number five times. I'm not going to delete that. I still got Bryce Paup in my phone. Yeah, no big deal.
Yeah. I love Bryce Paup. He was Defensive Player of the Year sometime in the mid-90s.
Yeah,
My younger brother still wears his Bryce Paup jersey to Buffalo games. He has a
really?
Bills That's... Bryce Paup jersey. That was a big
and
deal.
And the Bills have Bryce since... Paup. They've changed not only players, but uniforms twice since Bryce Paup played.
Wow, yeah.
Your brother's jersey is now three cycles behind. They went to the Canadian uniforms for a while,
yep.
And then they went to these
Blue.
Old kind of these half throwback uniforms that they wear now that I think people kind of like.
All right. So it was two uniforms ago.
Yeah, but the third one back. There's been two cycles all the way through now.
Yes, that I agree with. He has Bryce Paup, and I have Pete Metzelaars in my closet in the old blue and white. But yeah, Bryce Paup going to work for PJ Fleck out in Minnesota. So that's going to be a fun duo. They have an entire staff of people. It's not just PJ Fleck and Bryce Paup, but
just running those two running the show.
Yep.
Yeah, that'd be an intramural football team.
Andy, we still have topic number 10. We still have the weekly awards to wrap up here.
Number 10.
And we're going to start with Offensive Player of the Week. Who do you got?
I'm going to go with, we know the obvious ones. We can see the obvious ones. You know, I'm going to go Matt Ryan. We didn't talk about him in the show yet. And I just mentioned how Jared Goff did a good job keeping his eyes downfield even after pressure. He got better there. He's not good at it yet, but he got much better. Matt Ryan really stood out with pocket movement, eyes downfield. You know, Michael Bennett for Seattle got after a reporter in the locker room who kind of said, yeah, you didn't get any pressure on Matt Ryan in this game. What happened? And Bennett's answer in a certain number of expletives was, yes, we did get pressure. And Bennett was right. They did get to Matt Ryan. Matt Ryan just beat them. He played the position very, very well. He is he's had quite a season. He is a much better QB now than he was 3 months ago even.
Nice, nice. I'm going to give it to not Aaron Rodgers, but I'll give it to Jared Cook for that catch at the end. And also my Packer fan wife, who over the last couple years as I've begun work for the MMQB has come to despise the NFL and NFL season as she has become a football widow more and more. She doesn't get into the Packers as much as she used to. She used to be a pretty big Packers fan, and now she's kind of sour on the whole thing. But she sat down and got really into the end of this game, and when Jared Cook made that catch, I got to cue up the... do you know the Adult Swim old viral video, Too Many Cooks?
No, I don't.
Well, if you've never seen it, I would suggest doing all the drugs in your house and then sitting down and watching it. It's one of those types of videos. But they have they have a catchy, it's a spoof, it's like an 80s sitcom spoof type of thing, and they have a very catchy theme song that just all says right. Too many cooks a whole lot. So there you go.
I appreciate it, and I like Adult Swim. I think they do. They do the unedited Family Guy reruns sometimes, and they'll sometimes have stuff that Fox didn't show. That's
yes,
a free plug for Cartoon Network there. My defensive player, I'm going to go James Harrison because I want to make the point. A lot of people are probably going to say Eric Fisher lost the game for Kansas City with that holding foul and the 2-point conversion play. And Gary, you and I talk on the show all the time that in the NFL especially, usually penalties are a consequence not of you making a mistake, but of your opponent making a great play that forces you into a mistake.
Yep.
And that was an example of that. Harrison beat him with that outside hook move, that underneath hook move. It was the exact same move that Harrison beat him earlier in the game with for a sack. And that's what won the game for. That's what sealed the win for Pittsburgh. It wasn't that Fisher blew it and fell on his face and got a foul at the wrong time. It was that James Harrison beat him, and the penalty was the consequence of the play.
Yeah, James Harrison really good in this one. I'm going to give it to Micah Hyde, and the highlight was the intercepting the little that little quick screen, which. That's a gutsy move, and that's always a cool play when someone actually pulls that off. And I feel like guys are jumping that more and more.
Because it's such a tip. It's when you line those guys up in a stack position like that. There's only so many different directions they can go. And
but I feel like teams are running that little seam route off of that more.
Yeah, they are. So you mean the guy at the front of the stack, Dez Bryant, runs the seam route. So two things about that. For one, that we need to see the safeties. But remember we said Green Bay keeps both safeties back.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, then there's a safety to pick up that seam route because the safety would be along the seams, right in the seam route area. And so maybe that was the one case. The other thing is, my guess is Dallas probably had, we'd have to go look at this, they probably had formational tendencies, though, that it wasn't necessarily that Beasley was behind Bryant. It was that Beasley was behind Bryant and Prescott was under center or Witten was on the other side or whatever it was. There was something else that tipped off the rest of the formation because, without question, Micah Hyde knew what was coming on that play.
Yep. And he, he had a couple of nice plays. He did some good work on Cole Beasley when he was lined up against him, and had a nice pass breakup. I think it was Bryce Butler at that point on a what could have been a pretty big second and long conversion. So Micah Hyde gets my defensive player of the week. Andy, who do you have for special teams player of the week?
I'm going to play it seriously because there were some really important special teamers, and we know about the kickers. This was in a losing effort, and he didn't have the kind of game that most people hoped he would, but Tyreek Hill still gets mine because what you can't capture statistically are the yards that you create when teams try to avoid kicking to you. And this is why I think Devin Hester's a Hall of Famer, because there were a number of times where the field position was swung drastically, strictly as the very expensive insurance policy the Steelers took out and deciding not to let Hill touch the ball. I think that's true greatness. That impacts the game on a number of significant levels.
There you go. That was very thoughtful.
And he did have one nice return, too, when he got one. Didn't he have one up, if I recall? Maybe not. They you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to go Tyreek Hill, and I'm also going to go the Steelers coverage unit and just cover my bases there.
Everyone who played special teams in that game gets an award. Everybody gets a trophy day. That's what it was in Kansas City tonight. I was considering Danny Smith, the Steelers special teams coordinator, for basically after that opening kickoff. For they kicked deep to Tyreek Hill and they covered it well. So
yeah, they did.
But I'm not going to give him that award. And I'll give my special teams player of the week award to Mason Crosby because he kicked a ball twice and it went through the uprights. And like I said, they were those sweet knucklers where it sort of went all over the place and made everyone, I don't know, probably lose some bodily fluids as they watch that. So
for
Coach of the Week, Andy.
Coach of the Week, I'm gonna go with I'm going to go Mike Tomlin of the Steelers. And we don't think about him because he's not really the schemer there. You know, Todd Haley runs the offense and Keith Butler runs the defense. I've been to Steelers practices. You see Tomlin. Tomlin's very much involved, and he's a teacher of players. He teaches them individually. Mm-hmm. He's hands-on like that. I'm not a big rah-rah guy, but I do believe there's something to that. I'm just not one because I've never played the game, so I can't relate to it. But I think there is something to it, and I thought it was rude of Terry Bradshaw to reduce Tomlin to being a rah-rah coach because he's great at that, but he's so much more. And what I've always liked about Tomlin, he came from the Tony Dungy Cover 2 school, the Tampa 2. That's what he taught. That's how he got a head coaching job. And when he got to Pittsburgh, he realized this team runs a very different system. It's worked very well for them. They're built to keep running it. I'm going to take a back seat and let other coaches do what they've done so well, and I'm going to do the other things that I do well. It's a very humble approach to coaching. He didn't try to put his stamp on the team and leave his mark. He took over a great organization and kept the trains running, and you see it now, and now they've got this team in the AFC Championship game.
That was very nice. Yeah, I remember when they hired him, that was the big thing. It was oh my God, the Steelers are about to completely revamp their defense. They're going to go
and
away
they never
the,
did, yeah.
Yeah. Coach Luke, I'm going to give it to Romeo Crennel. I thought they did some creative things against the Patriots, all for naught in the end. But, you know, what are you going to do when you just don't have the firepower to match up? But along with having Jadeveon Clowney on his team, I thought they mixed it up pretty well. And you know, sort of the way they mix it up, Clowney dropped into coverage a couple times. Clowney came free on that one where he didn't quite get there. It was a little screen pass, but you know, he absolutely destroyed Brady right after he let it go. I thought the Texans defense did everything they possibly could have done in this one. So
and they really blazed a new trail this year. The double A gap look that people have heard all about, that got replaced this season by what's called five across, where there's just five defensive linemen lined up one across from each of the offensive linemen. Mm-hmm. And Houston was the leader with it, and that's where Bursalis, he got those two sacks against the center, Andrews. In this game, that came out of five across. Crennel had the most dynamic new defensive front and all the concepts with it, and we're going to hear more about it next season, the year after that, because it's the new double A gap.
All right. That's something to look forward to. You know what else you can look forward to is the Thursday show, the Look Ahead show, big deep dive of the conference championship games, as well as all sorts of coaching hire talk. What's going to go on with Jared Goff? I want to know. I can't wait for the show. Mailbag as well. Send your questions. Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI on Twitter. We're both on Facebook. Write as long as you want with your Facebook questions or email talkback@themmqb.com. But that will do it for this show right now. Thank you, as always, to our producer, Matt Havia, straight in from Montreal to work the show tonight. Editor Chris Basil always makes us sound good, and our researcher, Jeff Irwin. Most of all, thank you to all of you out there for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You really are the best, and we really do want to hear from you, especially with mailbag questions. We want to talk about what you guys want us to talk about, so we're curious. We love hearing from you. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. That includes the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Thursday.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.